This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Mary Sherratt, the author of Daughters of the Witching Hill. It's a new novel from Houghton Mifflin. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Good. I'm very well. And just a little detail, my last name is actually pronounced Sherratt.
I was going to ask you about that. I should have asked you before.
Never mind.
Thanks for correcting me. So it's hard not to start here. You're an American author. You live in England. How long have you been living in England?
Well, we moved here in 2002. It's a very long story. I mean, basically, my husband accepted a job offer in the Manchester area, and we started out living in Manchester city center, and then we moved out to the country. And we just sort of accidentally happened to buy a house that viewed out onto Pendle Hill, and that provided the inspiration for this novel.
Well, and of course you must have done research pretty extensively on the history of the period that you're talking about here.
Well, a lot of research, but it kind of crept up on me slowly. Everywhere you go in the Pendle region, it's steeped in these legends of the witches. And in the beginning, I thought it was just folklore. And then I realized they were real people, and that was what really grabbed me. So then I did all the research to find out who these people were and why they were accused of witchcraft and the whole backstory. It was just incredible.
Well, I should probably add for people who are listening, the Daughters of the Witching Hill takes place in the, I'd say, from roughly 1580 to 1612, covering a period of English history when witchcraft was alive and was really part of the day-to-day life of many people out in the countryside. And the focus of the novel is this wonderful, incredible character, Bess Southerns, who is... The key, I think she's really the key character, but of course her daughter is in it, her other children, many other people are involved, and in fact the witchcraft trial that takes place late in the novel brings in other people that maybe were unexpected early on. But you start kind of inhabiting her as the character, and you switch back and forth between the different characters. But maybe you could tell me which of the characters you feel closest to.
Well, it all started with Bess Southerns. She was the most notorious of the witches. She's more commonly known by her nickname, Old Demdike. And it's incredible the way she was described in the primary source materials, a wonderful discovery of witches in the county of Lancaster by Thomas Potts, the official court clerk. He described her as this really, really dangerous woman. She was 80 years old, and everyone was afraid of her, and she was the general agent for the devil in all these parts. And when I was reading the primary source material, I was amazed at how this 80-year-old woman's strength of character stood out in this document that was written to condemn her. She sounded like an incredible person. And what really intrigued me was not that she was arrested on witchcraft charges at the end of her life, is that she had this full career. It said in the documents that she had been a witch for 50 years. So she had decades of a career as a cunning woman, as a healer, before the authorities cracked down on her. And it also came out in the trial material that the neighbors called on her for healing. She healed children and also livestock. And the people that called on her for healing did not speak against her in the trial.
Were they able, I mean, actually in the historical record, did anyone speak in her behalf, or were they all just too terrified of what would happen to them? I mean, clearly, these were country people, uneducated, in some cases illiterate, and for them, this was a very dangerous event.
We don't have any record of anybody speaking up for her or coming to her defense, but it's interesting the people that chose not to speak against her.
Well, and you know, to go back to the way you imagine the characters, I thought it was brilliant to show how the day-to-day life of the people in that area, and probably in other parts of England and all, you know, for that matter, Europe, they were closer to the land, they were closer to the old ways, as, you know, as kind of pre-Christian ways that had continued on in the culture. And so the idea of there being magic and spirits was not foreign to anybody in that time. But for the people like her, it was a way for her to actually exist, because they were so poor. In a lot of ways, it looks, you know, the healing that she did was a way for her to earn a living.
Exactly. It was a way of life. It was a cottage industry. It was basically her family trade. She practiced as a cunning woman. Her daughter did for a while, and obviously the granddaughter, Alison Device, the whole family was set up so she would carry on the family trade, and she was probably about 17 at the time of her trial.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the, I love this character that comes to Bess, whose name is Tibb, T-I-B-B. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how that was described in the record, and then how you imagined this guy to be.
Well, it's very interesting that English witchcraft and magic has there are several differences between English witchcraft and continental European witchcraft. And one of the things that sets the tradition of English witchcraft apart is the importance of the familiar spirit. The familiar spirit took center stage. You could not be a cunning person without your familiar spirit. So basically, this was a spirit. People have the stereotype that, you know, they had black cats and that was their familiar. That had nothing to do with a pet or anything. It was a spirit, a helper from the spirit world that was your otherworldly ally. Without this otherworldly ally, you could not work your magic. This was the strong belief. And every cunning woman, every person who worked magic as a living, the local healer, who used magic for this purpose, would have their familiar, and that's how it worked. So if you were interrogated on these charges and you earned your living as a cunning man or a cunning woman, and the local magistrate asked you about your familiar, you wouldn't deny your familiar. You would talk about it, because that's the whole basis of your trade, of your livelihood. So Tibb appeared to her as a beautiful young man. The story that she told her magistrate, and she was even like bragging about it, not covering it up as something shameful, is that she was a middle-aged woman walking along after a fruitless day's begging past a stone quarry near the village of New Church in Pendle. The quarry still exists and you can still visit it. So she was walking past this quarry at sunset, which is called Daylight Gate in the local dialect. It's a very beautiful word. And so at twilight, this beautiful young man steps out of the quarry. He has golden hair, his coat is half brown, half black. He introduces himself as Tibb, and he says he'll teach her all she needs to know about magic, and he'll help her and raise her out of poverty if only she'll let him teach her. And her reaction to this was to like freak out and run away and block it out and pretend that it hadn't happened. But he was very persistent, appearing to her and reappearing to her over time, until finally they worked out this working relationship and she came to work with this spirit. So that's the story that she told her magistrate.
And was it your invention that she had this kind of moral, ethical concern that she had to wrestle with? Was this good or was, and of course Tibb in the book, and she talk, he gives her instructions about how to live. In other words, this is really about living a good life and using these powers, the ability to foretell, all of that is for good. It's to save people and heal people and to make things better. There's a sort of feeling almost like in the Navajo sand painting that you create the painting in order to bring the world back into balance. And there's this feeling that all of this power, which comes from the elf dame you know, the elf realm, which is not of this world, is being used in this world to make it better. And that seems to come more from you than maybe than the historical record would indicate.
Yeah, obviously the people, the magistrate and the people at the witch trial aren't going to paint this in any positive light, but I tried to give her a voice. If she had her own tale to tell, it would be a different tale than what the magistrate was telling. And the fact that we know from the trial records that people called on her for healing and blessing and trusted her enough to heal their children, that indicates that she thought she was working for good.
And you also contrast her friend, who is her best friend from youth, and it's at a certain point in the story, and of course it changes later on, but in a certain point in the story, they become enemies. The other woman uses the power, gains her own familiar, and you know she becomes known as an evil person, using the power for her own purposes rather than for good. Is that also historical, or did you bring her up kind of on your own?
Well, the whole backstory is historical. The way she came to her powers is what I kind of invented. Basically, the trial tells us that Bess was the original witch that initiated all the others, so it wasn't such a stretch that she would teach magic to her best friend. But what Anne Chaddox, her best friend, does is take this power and use it to protect her family members. So her daughter was under threat from the landlord's son, who basically was trying to coerce her daughter to have sex with him, otherwise he would turn the whole family out of their cottage. And her daughter had no rights to defend herself against this man, and so she used magic against him. That was the only power an impoverished woman would have, to defend her daughter. That's all true. That's from the historical record. When the magistrate accuses her of witchcraft, she said, yes, I cursed him, yes, and I don't regret it, and this is what I did to defend my daughter. So that's all historical. The whole kind of friendship and then enmity between them was kind of the fictional thing I put in there.
Well, it's great the way you cast the period, I think, really well, that we sometimes, it's hard for us to realize what it was like for poor people living in the country, how powerless they were, how unfair the power relationships were in a feudal, more or less feudal society.
Yeah.
And of course then there's the backdrop of all of the warring between Catholicism and Protestantism. I loved the way you talked about some of the landed gentry who retained their loyalty to Catholicism. And of course people then at that time were willing to die and often did die for their faith. As of course all the witches did, literally dying because of who they were. It was very sad at the end. Of course, I don't want to telegraph the ending for anybody, but you know it is it's beautiful. You become really affected by these people and their lives, and then of course it is really sad when they die.
A sad march of history. But that was one of the things that surprised me the most when I did the research, is how witchcraft and Catholicism were conflated during this period, and how her spells and charms that she used for healing were Catholic prayers, and how the local authorities viewed that as evidence of diabolical witchcraft. It would never occur to me, this conflation of Catholicism and witchcraft that existed in England during this period. It was just amazing for me to learn about in the research.
Well, I wonder if maybe there's some of that too in the American Salem witch trials and others of the same period. I don't know enough about it to know whether that's true, but it is interesting to think of it in those terms.
It's interesting.
You know, I guess we're sort of trained up to think of the witch trials as being expressions of psychological repression and things like that, you know, maybe from some of the other literary works that we've seen, like Arthur Miller. But, your focus, I think, is much more on the daily lives of people, and I was really impressed with that.
Thank you.
And especially since you're an American, you know, you've only been there for a short while, so that it's an imaginative feat, I think, on your part. Are these characters people that, or this era or this place, is this now going to be something that you work with in the future for other books?
I would love to return to this with other projects. Yeah, right now I'm working on a book about Hildegard of Bingen, who was a 12th century nun, so it's a bit different. But I would definitely love to return to early modern England and this whole kind of rural world of superstition and magic. It's a very, very interesting and rich period, because for those people, magic was real. It wasn't just the poor and ignorant who believed in it, but also the powerful and wealthy. Probably the most superstitious person in the whole country was the king, King James, who was obsessed with the occult and wrote a whole book on demonology and how to hunt witches. And he expected his magistrates to read this book and go out and find these witches.
Right, which is probably one of the reasons why they did it. It was to please the king and to gain favor and power for themselves. And, you know, kind of awful to realize that, you know, that his obsession with the occult, which was probably, I mean, it's all really complicated, because in that period there really was much more sense of transformative spirituality at work, which is really
right.
What magic is about. And of course, I always have this feeling, I don't know whether you would share this, but, you know, when I go to places where there have been spiritual events or where magic has taken place, you know, you try to imagine if it's possible to find those spirits again, kind of like Neil Gaiman talks about in some of his books, that the spirits are there. It's just they've lost their power because people don't believe in them anymore.
I think in this part of the world, the spirits are all still there. I think if you go walking around here, walk the public footpaths and visit the places where these women lived, you do, if you are sensitive to these things, you do feel a powerful presence. And that was part of my riding process, walking and riding. I have a horse, all these trails through Pendle Forest to kind of walk in their footsteps and listen to their voices. And it was a powerful experience. I feel like the ancestors are still alive in the land, and they tell their stories, and their stories are a part of the landscape. And, you know, their stories will never die, because it's such a part of the folklore in the region, and they'll never be forgotten.
So do you think your book will be received differently in England, and particularly around there?
It will be interesting to see. I have a lot of local interest in it, and I've been invited to speak to several groups already. Even before I finished it, during the research phase, I was invited to speak to the local Rotary Club and the local Heritage Society, and then next year I have some bookings for speaking. So everybody is incredibly interested in it, so it'll be interesting to see what they make of the book when they read it.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's very powerful and empowering, I think, to women. You know, clearly it gives, you know, for anyone who's interested in spirituality and women's role in spirituality, I think it has a tremendous power.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. That was one of my goals.
Well, and let me ask you just quickly about the Hildegard of Bingen connection. What is that going to be, a novel also?
Yes, it's a novel, and she's not that far removed from the witches as you might think, because she also healed with herbs and gemstones, and she invented her whole system of medicine, and she was guided by visions and a very spiritual woman whose spirituality often diverged a lot from the institutional church. So she's a really powerful, inspirational figure for me.
Yeah, no, I've read books about Hildegard, and she is her mysticism is very powerful. This is going to be another novel?
Yes.
Well, that'll be very interesting. And I guess you're from Minnesota originally.
Uh-huh.
And you've written books that have to do with Minnesota, too.
Yes. Yeah, my first two novels were Minnesota-based, and I might return there in the future.
So are you planning to come back to the United States to tour for this book? And will that be part of what you do?
Yeah, I'll be going to the Virginia Book Fair in March, and then in April I'll be going to Boston and Minnesota to promote the books, and looking forward to that and doing readings and talking to people and looking forward to being in Minnesota again.
Well, and you'll wait until it's warmer, because as we talk, which is in January of 2010, I think Minnesota is as cold as it could possibly be.
Yeah, I'm a wimp. I've lived away for so long. I would completely be a wimp now.
But although I've heard that England is experiencing colder than usual winter.
Well, yeah, 1 inch of snow and the country is paralyzed because people don't have snow tires or snow plows.
That may change. They may have to adapt.
Yeah.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I think, I do want to say, I think this is a really great book. It really inhabited my imagination while I was reading it, and afterwards, I really would recommend it to people. It's called The Daughters of the Witching Hill by Mary Sharrett, and I hope you pronounced your name correctly that time.
Yes.
And it's being published, actually, officially in April 2010. This interview will probably run sometime in February 2010, so people will have to go looking to pre-order the book, which I hope they will do. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. And thank you, Mary, for talking to me.
Thank you, David.